Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
A wise old friend in Perth after my second injury, you know, after a fairly long sort of rehab and all the rest, it happened again, and I was down in the dumps feeling pretty sorry for myself, and he kind of just squared me up in a way and said, mate, rather than just sitting there saying, like, why me? Your question should really be, what can I make of it?
Hi, I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a podcast about living a more beautiful and fired-up life. Here we will continue my 10-year nomadic journey, living out of one bag, in search of more connection, more awakeness, less consuming, less loneliness, and less bloody scrolling. I'll be inviting you to join me in finding better ways to radically love and save our one wild and precious life on this planet. My guest for this episode is David Pocock.
I'm David Pocock, a former rugby player, student, and someone who's trying to figure out what's next.
And right there, we see the true character of one of the world's most successful sportsmen, humble to a fault. You might know David for one of two reasons. First, perhaps for being a weapon on the rugby field, the 79th captain of the Wallabies and the only Australian player to be included in World Rugby's Team of the Decade. Or, the second option, for being a rugby player and the darling of sports media who also speaks out on race, refused to marry his best mate Emma until marriage equality laws passed in this country, and for being arrested for chaining himself to a digger in a coal mine protest, and who at the end of 2020 shocked the world by announcing he was leaving sport at the height of his career to devote his energies to the environment. I know him for this second reason. I hadn't actually had a chance to catch up with him since he made his big decision, so I figured this podcast might be a really great forum for it. In this chat, we cover quite a bunch of hard questions: eating meat for the planet, being a grown-up, feminism, and getting comfortable with being weird and different. Now, when David and I start talking, and I should warn you, we don't tend to draw breath, and it's been known to freak other people out.
I've set aside a couple of hours, so all good.
The other thing I'll say, Dave is one of the most considered thinkers I've ever met. He never throws out a line without reflecting fully. The pauses in this podcast are quite long as a result, but Lindsay and I, the producer, we decided to leave them in, and I invite you to find them as an almost pause for a reflection yourself as you listen to our conversation. I think it's also worth sharing with you because it's such a commendable and very likeable thing and totally rare. He prepped for days before our interview and followed up with me several times afterwards to clarify some of his answers and to share some reading sources you might all like. So you'll find them attached to the show notes. I started by asking Dave to remind me how our friendship first started. I came across you because you struck me as incredibly wild, but you might need to help me out here. How did we actually first meet? Do you remember?
I can't actually remember. My partner Emma and I had used your cookbooks for a while and kind of followed what you were doing. And
I think it was Instagram. I think it was Instagram at first, and then we arranged to have a coffee. And you and I just locked heads and talked philosophy and Jungian theory.
Yeah, I often get accused of being intense, and I think I had met my match in intensity. So we've had a few good chats.
We have, and we've shared some intense reads, long reads, and philosophical books over the years. And in fact, I might even get that list together and share it on my blog post so people can tap into what we've been reading and sharing notes on. But thank you so much for joining me at a really important juncture in your life. And I want to speak specifically about your most recent leap, in which you essentially gave up on footy, not because there was a scandal, not because of injury, and not because you'd sort of reached your peak and you were going downhill. In fact, quite the opposite, most commentators would say. You decided to leave because you wanted to focus on activism and your work in the environment and in climate change. That is a huge leap to make, and very few people in your position have done it. David, can you just explain what went through your head to help you make that decision, to take that really bold leap into the unknown and into the wild?
I guess, you know, leaving rugby to focus on conservation or climate change work is really an easier and less nuanced way of, I guess, talking about making a really big life decision and what, as humans, that takes. And for me, it was a really tough decision. And, you know, like all these big decisions, I guess something that you really grapple with. And, you know, we've got so many competing voices and desires, and it's really sifting through that and trying to actually listen to that part of ourselves that we know ultimately we have to listen to, that we're accountable to in some way. And, you know, I think all of us know that somewhere deep inside us we have that voice that knows what's right for us. And I'd sensed that it was time to move on. I'd felt my energies shifting in a different direction. But, you know, rugby and professional sport was also really the only thing I knew. I'd been playing professional rugby since I was 17. It was a huge part of my life, and, you know, it had provided me with a whole bunch of things, from, you know, the feeling of being part of a team and connected to something bigger than myself, you know, structure, goals, and also, you know, an identity, you know, David, the rugby player, as well as, yeah, a good income, a sense of security. And, you know, you're also being told by our culture and, you know, even people close to me, some, you know, family saying, listen, just make hay while the sun shines, like make as much money as you can now because it won't last forever. And then one day you can do all these other things that, you know, seem crazy to other people. You can go and focus on them. And it's a valid argument. I mean, growing up in a farming family where money was often a point of stress, it's something that's kind of weighed on me. But yeah, ultimately got to the point where I decided, you know, it was really time to actually step out. And
was timing and the urgency of the climate movement something that played on you?
The urgency is certainly there, and, you know, that's I think things are only going to get more urgent the way that we're heading. But I guess it was more a personal thing, and knowing that I had to actually step out of that sort of comfort zone into something else. And, you know, I'm still really figuring that out.
Maybe just share with us, because I know that you say you're still figuring it out, but from what I know of what you and Emma are embarking on, I mean, you're about to head back to Zimbabwe to work on a really big project over there. Could you just give us a really quick overview of what that is?
Sure. So we're trying to build a model of land management which essentially brings together regenerative agriculture, conservation, and community development. So working to build a more holistic model of land management where local people benefit from not only their land, but also from the wildlife that they live alongside and often don't benefit from. They bear the costs of living next to things like elephant and lion and all these things that are a real cost to them. Economically and also socially.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of at the nexus of everything that's happening in the climate movement, and it's particularly with second and third world countries. It's a really interesting project, and I won't drill down into too much of it now because I know you're about to sort of embark on it, and maybe we'll come back to that in a year's time and hear how it all went. I know that you do draw on a lot of philosophy, and we share some of the books and the philosophies that have influenced us into the climate movement. What are some of the books that you drew on, or even theories that you referenced as you made this really big decision, this big leap into the unknown?
The work of James Hollis has been really important in my life. I was introduced to him, probably almost a decade ago, and I've really found his work deeply challenging, but also incredibly useful in trying to work out what it means to live a life of meaning.
Is there a particular phraseology or approach that he, because he's written countless books, is there one particular notion that guided you?
Well, I think there's been a number of things that have really challenged me to shift the way that I think and live. One of the big ones was in 2013, 2014, I had back-to-back knee reconstructions and essentially sat on the sideline for two full years of rugby, which, you know, when you have perspective is really not one of life's great challenges. You're relatively healthy, well looked after, still being paid, still very privileged, all these things. But in that moment, your whole sense of identity and being able to contribute is really being shaken. And I grew up in a fairly sort of Christian fundamentalist home and really had this idea of God sort of being, you know, in a way some sort of vending machine where if you do the right things, good things happen to you.
Yeah.
And one of the things that James Hollis' work really challenged me on was that we actually don't have a contract with the universe.
Yeah.
Things happen that are outside of our control, and really all we can do is make the most of it. And a wise old friend in Perth, after my second injury, you know, after a fairly long sort of rehab and all the rest, it happened again, and I was down in the dumps feeling pretty sorry for myself, and he kind of just squared me up in a way and said, mate, rather than just sitting there saying like, why me, your question should really be, what can I make of it? And for me, that was a really big shift, and I guess a bit of a turning point on the journey of what James Hollis would really call growing up, like finally actually taking personal responsibility. You know, we as humans, there's always someone to blame, but the reality is that we're the only consistent character in this kind of drama that we call our lives. And it's really up to us to find meaning and to live in a way that honors what's come into the world out of us.
All right. So James Hollis, is there anyone else that guided you? Any other texts that you drew on, philosophies, mantras?
Well, one of the things I'd been reading earlier last year where I was kind of really grappling with this decision and whether to sign on for another couple of years or call it quits was Rob Bell. And I really love, he's such a great communicator. And I really love some of the ideas he talks about and the way he kind of really grapples with meaning in life. And one of the things he said, which really struck a chord, was you can leave when it feels like a graduation, or you can hang in there and have to leave when it feels like a divorce. And yeah, it really resonated where it felt like this was stepping into something new, something unknown. And, you know, it's that thing of, I guess, finding your own path. You know, Joseph Campbell talks about if you can see the path laid out in front of you, you know it's not your path, and your path is really every step you take and trying to figure it out for yourself. And it really felt like the right time to take that step and try and find what's next and follow what's interesting.
That one foot in front of the other approach, it's so simple, but it can be very, very comforting in a complex world. I've got to say, as somebody from the sidelines, and I'm going to try not to use footy analogies and metaphors here, but, you know, I've observed you as somebody who's got this incredible potency. And as a man, a white man, who just personifies the ultimate sort of warrior physicality and mentality, I mean, in terms of anything that can emulate a wartime environment, I would say that rugby would be it. I mean, boxing is almost as physical, but it's very individual, this notion of this kind of camaraderie. And for you then to do this flip and to actually turn your back on it and go, I'm going to use all of that potency, that white male Australian potency, and move it into the environmental movement, it's probably one of the most powerful things I've seen in that sort of influencer community in terms of people in the spotlight doing something really radical. I'm wondering if you've got any thoughts on why so few influencers and celebrities and people in the spotlight are doing this kind of thing, not maybe to the extent that you have, but who are willing to get wild, who are willing to take that leap and voice up. I mean, do you feel the same way? Do you look around and go, where are the influencers speaking out on politics, the climate, on what matters?
From the first half of your question, I guess I really don't see it as turning my back on rugby. Personally, I loved my time in rugby and you know, I couldn't have done anything else with the upbringing and the motivations as a young kid. I served that out as best I could and got to the point where I realized I needed to move on to something else. So very much see that as a really important part of the journey, but realize that it's not actually, it wasn't serving me anymore in the way that it once had. In terms of taking a stand, I mean, this is something that I've been really interested in and you know, I'm really grateful for my upbringing and the way it kind of got me curious about social change. You know, growing up in that Christian environment, something about it just didn't sit right with me. And I kind of went on this almost as a, you know, in my late teens, I left home at 17, moved across the country. And you get to this point where you're like, okay, well, I believe all this stuff, but that's just what my family believes. Like, what do I actually believe? What resonates with me? What do I see as important or true to me? And so I kind of went down this rabbit hole of reading from, you know, the early Christians, liberation theology, and then that really got me onto like Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Dorothy Day, Desmond Tutu, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, all these people who we really hold up on a pedestal and say, wow, look at these amazing people and what they did. But the thing that really stood out for me is the more you read both what they'd written but also books about them, the more you realize, hang on, like these are really ordinary, flawed, sometimes deeply flawed humans like me and you, and they experience fear and all the other things that we do, yet they acted courageously in the face of their fears. And, you know, I really think it comes down to moral courage and, I don't know, finding something inside you that says this is what I believe in, and I'm going to actually take a stand. And
I think it's a really interesting and very compassionate point that you make, is that these change makers that we revere, they were ordinary, but what distinguishes them is that they tapped into their moral compass, and then that guided them, and they took the leap, they took the steps that were required. But David, I mean, what would you say to people who might be in the public eye listening to this, or who have some sort of influence? They may even just have an influence within their family or in their office environment that can get them to that point of moral courage, because the world is needing so much of it right now. You've taken the leap. You've read the text. You've been incredibly intense about it. You know, what could you actually offer as some mindset sort of switching?
One of the things I thought about a lot as a younger adult was these people that we've just talked about and the social movements they were involved in, whether it was, you know, the fight against slavery, civil rights, against apartheid, all these things. I certainly like to think, and I think most people would like to think, that they would have been right there, you know, fighting against slavery, wanting civil rights, saying apartheid was an awful thing to do. Yet history shows us that most people were pretty neutral, kind of just got on with their lives, maybe didn't agree with it, but certainly weren't out there. It was a very small percentage of the population that were actually active. And you know, one of my heroes is Desmond Tutu, and you know, with he's just such a wise, humorous old guy, and he talks about how if you're neutral in a situation of injustice, you've chosen the side of the oppressor. And kind of, you know, as only Desmond Tutu can, he gives this example of if an elephant's got its foot on the tail of a mouse, and you say to the mouse, "Oh, I'm neutral," the mouse is not going to appreciate your neutrality.
No.
So, you know, I think it's actually thinking about the issues that we face. You know, climate change and the biodiversity crisis are the biggest issues I think Homo sapiens have ever faced. And, you know, it's not just us that's at risk, it's millions of species. And are we willing to actually have the courage to act, and potentially at an expense to ourselves? But really, I think there is so much meaning to be found in being part of what someone like Joanna Macy calls the great turning, where we all know things are bad.
Yeah.
Things have to change, and we need more people saying, okay, things have to change and I'm going to be part of it. And you know, one person isn't going to change the world, but when we have more and more people saying, right, let's do this, I'm willing to actually sacrifice a bit, and you know, for everyone that's going to look different. I guess that's the way I've thought about it.
You pick up on the word sacrifice, and I think that's a really important thing. I mean, do you find that that's something that is not played out, it's not revered, it's not honored in our culture today?
I'm not sure. I mean, when I say sacrifice, maybe it's maybe just a real kind of athlete language.
I don't think so. I think it is something that, I mean, you do use it in sport, but we used to use it throughout culture. You know, it was part of religious traditions. It was part of philosophical traditions that you sacrificed something of your own for the greater good, and that then provided happiness at a personal level.
And I think you've just struck on something which I think is really important, is that as humans, I think what we're after is meaning. And yet we have been sucked into this lie that what we should be seeking is happiness when, exactly as you said, happiness is a byproduct.
Yeah.
And it's fleeting. It's not something that we should be trying to orient our whole lives to defining, because we're going to be disappointed, and we are. And you look at where capitalism has got us and is taking us, we really have to rethink the way that we are organizing our lives, our communities, our societies, our economies. And, you know, for me, that in many ways starts with moral courage and trying to take a stand, however small it is, but something that feels right.
Yeah, and I think because that's such an overwhelming influence, capitalism, the individualism, the neoliberalism, I think a lot of people are feeling that a line in the sand needs to be drawn. Is that something that you felt in that wild decision that you made? A line in the sand, i.e. Stepping back from football to focus on environmentalism, it basically said no. It said no to the capitalist cycle, the stuckness.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that was my thinking. I don't think it was a kind of a, you know, shoving it to that kind of part of our culture. It was more a personal thing of these other things feel more meaningful. I want more time to pursue them. You know, for a long time I've had these other interests outside of rugby, and I've kind of kept them rolling along, and they've really provided me with a great outlet and interest to balance the professional sport kind of lifestyle and that bubble that you can get sucked into. But yeah, felt like, okay, this is the next part of the journey, and I don't know exactly what it looks like, but in making that, the sense of relief that you feel, and you know, almost this energy, like it's it doesn't give you a lot more clarity, and all of a sudden all your problems are gone. You still have to wake up in the morning and get on with it, but I imagine it's probably in some ways similar to you deciding to shut down I Quit Sugar.
Like, very.
It's a crazy thing to do. Mm. Like, you're a mad person for taking that decision. There's so many other things you could have done to keep making a buttload of money and you know, being that person. But I don't know, yeah, for other reasons you decided that's not what you wanted to do.
Yeah, and it was personal for me as well, but I suppose I felt that drawing a line in the sand was what I needed to do to enable me to move on to that other meaningful stuff, that other stuff that was personally drawing me out into the world of climate change action. So, yeah, it's I think it is that it's very similar, and I relate to taking that leap and the loneliness of taking that leap. But you've been speaking out a bit, and it might not have been as conscious as you just want to be the person who speaks out on it. In fact, what I know of you is that being out there in the public eye and sticking your head up is just not your natural inclination. But I sort of think about the way that you and Emma got married. You basically made a commitment that you were not going to have a ceremony until marriage equality laws came into play in Australia. And you have also attended a number of protests and put your body on the line by tying yourself to a tractor in a protest up at a coal mine, and, you know, risked arrest and so on. I'm just kind of interested in why you feel that people are not speaking out as much.
I mean, I think culturally there's a number of things in Australia. If you stick your head up too high, it gets, you know, you get cut down. There's that real sort of tall poppy, don't rock the boat, just get on with it, mate, kind of attitude. So I'm not sure. I guess what I do know from the things that I've decided are important and worth getting involved in and sort of making a stand on is that they've often been made personal. And so, you know, with the marriage equality stuff, Emma and I had friends who we didn't feel like we wanted to join some, you know, marriage thing that a few of our friends, should they want to, legally couldn't. And so, I mean, it was no real cost to us. We kind of said, okay, well, until the laws change, we won't be part of that. And when it came to getting arrested on a coal mine, I guess there were a bunch of things that led up to that. I had, you know, done all the usual stuff, signed petitions, been to the marches, you know, and now, like it's happening all over the place, they building a coal mine in the middle of a forest, like in a critically endangered box gum woodland. And again, it was personal. I'd been involved in some community development work in Zimbabwe, and I remember one, like, really, it was so hot and humid, and we were kind of, we'd been meeting with people in the morning, and we were sitting under the shade of this tree, and I think Emma was inside interviewing a teacher for a report we were putting together, and I was talking to this community development worker who's one of the most charismatic people I've met. His name's Paul Kanye. He sometimes refers himself as Kanye East. and he does a great job teaching sort of sustainable agriculture practices to rural farmers. And we were kind of talking about challenges and those sorts of things. And he kind of became really serious and looked me dead in the eye and just said, listen, the thing that I am most worried about for this community is climate change. And he said, we here in rural Zimbabwe can do nothing about it. It's rich countries like yours that can do something about it and must do something about it, because we've got no money to deal with it. So, you know, you need to go back there and tell people to take it seriously. Fast forward, you know, 4 or 5 years, and I'm up at Morse Creek, and there just to kind of show solidarity with protesters at this proposed coal mine. And I meet Rick Laird, who's a fifth generation farmer, like soul of the earth, head of the local fire service. Just a great guy. Never been arrested before. And we got chatting, and then I guess having grown up on a farm, his story really resonated with me. And you know, after spending an afternoon together, he kind of said to me, listen, mate, like, if you're willing to get arrested, I'll get arrested with you. And it was, I guess, just really saying, okay, well, this is something I think is important, and at some point you've got to make a stand. And if you look at the history of social change, this stuff doesn't just happen. Like, it's up to usually a very small percentage of the population saying, enough's enough. I'm willing to give up my civil liberties for something I really care, and for future generations, to try and change things. And so I guess that's it. That's how I got there. I would love to see more people getting involved, and I think we have to if things are going to change. But having said that, you know, over 300 people got arrested at the coal mine in Laird State Forest, and it still went ahead, and hundreds of hectares have been bulldozed, and Gomeroi sacred sites were destroyed, and it continues. And you know, as an Australian, our farmers are getting screwed twice. One, we're building coal mines and all these gas projects in next to their farms, so they're dealing with, you know, dust, noise pollution, affecting groundwater. And then secondly, climate change is seriously going to and already affected them. Like, the average farm income has gone down 20% since the year 2000 due to climate change. Farmers kind of do it tough at the best of times for a lot of them. So we're certainly making it more challenging for them.
You picked up on the farming thing, and it's really interesting. One of the other things you've been...
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Outspoken on, from a personal passion point of view, is meat farming. By now, I imagine you would have some kind of elevator pitch that you have to pull out at dinner parties when a vegan calls you, you know, to account for your meat eating. What's your take on it? What's your response as a climate activist who also eats meat? What do you say?
So this is a thorny topic.
Here we go. Let's strap ourselves
that
in.
That requires nuance, and I guess, yeah, is very hard to convey in a tweet where so much seems to happen these days. I guess, as I see it, I have so much respect for people who go vegan for environmental reasons, and I was kind of heading down that path, kind of went vegan for a while and was sort of really looking into it more. My concern is that it doesn't address the way that we're farming. So industrial agriculture is very much warfare against nature. And it, you know, I think it's no coincidence that it was sort of spawned from after World War II. It's like, we've got all these chemicals, what do we do with them? Oh, we can use them in farming. And so that industrial mindset is so widespread and has done so much damage. And we really have to address that. And I really see regenerative agriculture as a way to begin to not only address some of the environmental damage that we've done, like we're at the point where sustainable is no longer an option. Like, we've degraded that much land that we have to actually find ways to regenerate it and heal it. And regenerative agriculture is very much farming in a way that your aim is to increase biodiversity. Your aim is to enrich and build soil and also produce nutrient-dense food. And it's really working with nature rather than against it. Again, this is a hugely contested space. The reason I'm really interested in and passionate about regenerative agriculture is I feel like it starts to address some of the shifts in mindset that are required from us to actually live on this planet, that recognize that we're part of nature, and nature is a cycle of life and death. And to think that we can somehow remove ourselves from that cycle, we're totally kidding ourselves. And if we can actually find ways to close the loop in farming and use livestock to increase fertility.
When you say fertility, you mean fertility of the soil and of the cycle of biodiversity and so on, don't you? You don't just mean fertility of livestock.
No, of the soil. I mean, our well-being is totally linked to the well-being of the health of the soil. And so, I mean, yeah, we need to eat less meat, but I think we need to eat better meat. And I think that's the conversation that's missing, is that not all meat is created equal. If you look at taking livestock off of farms and putting them into feedlots and then trucking, you know, food from the farms to the feedlot, piping water, and it's an ecological disaster. Whereas if we can find ways to actually, you know, holistically manage livestock, produce nutrient-dense food, I think, you know, I think we all win, and there's really a bigger conversation here that needs to happen around our food system, because I mean, you know, you're all over this stuff with the work that you do, but, you know, as Aussies, we throw away 20% of our food, which is, you know, over $5 billion worth. And if we're purely worried about emissions, if food waste as an emission was a country, it would be number three after the US and China. So this really needs to be part of this bigger conversation rather than just saying, listen, if we just stop all animal agriculture and eat plants, we've sold it. We talk a lot about land degradation. One of the ways to actually begin to reverse that is by using livestock to mimic natural systems. So you think of, you know, really rich soils on the American Great Plains or the Serengeti with huge herds of animals, essentially following the rain, intensely grazed somewhere, then don't come back for 6 months a year. Going back to that natural system would be great, but there are now towns, cities, fences all over the place. So that's unviable at the moment. Maybe in the future we'll decide to do that. But at the moment, the best tool we have is well-managed livestock. And when you actually manage them holistically, you draw carbon into the soil. You're building soil carbon, which is sequestering carbon out of the atmosphere. So it potentially is a huge carbon sink that we can begin to draw down a lot of the emissions that we've created by burning fossil fuels. So I think regenerative agriculture has to be part of the future and an important solution to climate change.
I'm so glad you made that point. It's the point that I think a lot of the debate needs to pivot from. And look, just to pick up on it, it's actually more than 20% of food is wasted. It's quite a lot higher, and most of it is at the consumer level. It's us throwing our meals out. And I always argue, if you really want to be a conscious eater, just don't waste a single bit of food. That's where the real difference can actually be made if anyone's confused about whether to go vegan, vegetarian, or to continue eating meat. Mm-hmm. And what I would also add to that is, you know, it's come out recently that if we stopped wasting food, and if in fact we cut our food waste by only 50%, there's enough food on the planet to feed everybody. And that's a startling statistic. But I want to move on to a subject that's close to James Hollis's heart, and I know it's close to yours, is men. Maybe we can pick it up from, you know, where men are at in the climate debate, because they're noticeably absent. There's a lot of studies that have shown that it's perceived as kind of too feminine to carry a keep cup or to not, you know, to carry a reusable bag to the supermarket. Where do you think men are at, and why aren't they getting engaged?
Again, this is a pretty big topic. I mean, from my point of view, it's really not a surprise that in our sort of really patriarchal culture, where the feminine is, you know, less than and is something to be dominated, that men don't want to sort of stand up for the earth, which is, you know, the ultimate sort of embodiment of that feminine sort of regenerative being, that sort of cycle of life and death. And I'm not sure how exactly we change that. I have really found some of Bell Hooks's work really helpful. She wrote a book, I think it's called The Will to Change.
Yeah.
Which, you know, really, growing up, I saw feminism as this, you know, this thing for women who were clearly very passionate about it and probably yelled a bit too much. but I think the thing that I certainly missed was just how much patriarchy conditions boys to be disconnected from their feeling side. And I think we really see that in our culture, where men find it very hard to connect to their feelings and to express how they actually feel. And so I think it's got a lot to do with that. I think one of the other things in Western cultures is that we're really disconnected from the places that we live. And, you know, it's really difficult to love somewhere that you don't really know, and you're not going to stand up for something that you don't love. So it's rekindling that relationship with the places that we actually live, our homes. And I think one of the issues is that a lot of us don't actually live here. We're living in Twitter feeds and Netflix shows and all those other things. And there's nothing wrong with them in themselves, but I think they provide a sort of a real distraction from actually engaging with the world around us. And when we do that, I think it really sparks something in us. And, you know, it's really no surprise that Indigenous people are leading this sort of resistance to what we're doing to the earth, and what, and saying, like, listen, this is madness. We have to find ways to live as if we're part of nature, because we are.
Yeah.
And we all know that.
So can I ask, what are you doing personally to reconnect with your feelings and your connection to nature and that sort of feminine entity? What are you doing at a personal level?
Well, I think one of the great sort of intros to it is gardening. Like, I know for me it's been such a great way to, I don't know, get a bit grounded, for way of another word. Like, you're getting your hands in the soil, you're having to think about the seasons, the rain, the when do I water, how long do I water for, is there frost coming, all these other things that otherwise we can kind of just live in our houses and not ever think about these days. And I think that helped awaken something in me. I also feel incredibly lucky that as a kid, my dad and my grandfather were really into birds and kind of passed on this fascination and love of birds. I mean, as Australians, like, we have some of the most incredible birds in the world all around us. And so, I don't know, it's just so interesting once you take an interest and kind of get to know a few of their names and learn more about them. And you know, I think that's all part of it. It's like, it's the simple things we do every day, as much as just noticing and, you know, talking to people. I think that's one of the things that in a country like Australia, where we've been, you know, relatively very safe and lucky with COVID, that kind of almost slow down talking to people, they've kind of commented how they've started to notice trees that they've never noticed before, birds, all these things that are, you know, we're just too busy for. And I don't know, I think there's so much value in that sort of thing. And, you know, it's that old saying, if you look at a tree and you see dollar bills, you're going to treat the forest one way. If you look at a tree and, you know, you see a tree, you're going to treat it another way. But if you look at a tree and you see that particular tree, it opens up a whole new world. And I don't know, for me, it's been such a gift to be able to, I don't know, find out more about this incredible world. And I'm still, we're all still so new to it all. I mean, you look around your neighborhood and, you know, I'd be lucky to be able to name 10 trees, but I could probably identify a few hundred logos of companies. So there's a long way to go, I think.
Men are often really good at attending to emergencies. You know, they used to sit around a campfire and chat away and, you know, share a few stories, and then somebody would go, hey, there's a tiger out there or a deer, let's go and get it. You know, we need some food. And they'd grab their spears and off they'd go, and they'd track it and follow it and hunt it down for 3 days and not complain and come back and it'd be wonderful, and they'd sit around the campfire and chat and talk shit again. But men can rise to an occasion super, super well, and it's why they're so great on playing fields and so on. The climate emergency is stark. It's right there. Now, it's not quite like a war, but it's we know it's an emergency. It's really, really blatantly obvious now. How can we get men to respond to this kind of emergency?
I mean, as humans, I think we've evolved to be really good at dealing with immediate threats. And you look at history and just, you know, the resources and ingenuity that have been mobilized for wars, the race to get someone on the moon, you know, just extraordinary. But when it comes to something that is perceived as kind of this slow-moving threat, and, you know, there's been billions of dollars spent on disinformation and propaganda against it, and it's kind of, it's a little bit iffy. It is a lot harder to, okay, what can I do? These issues are so huge. What can I possibly do as an individual? And that's the question to be grappling with. Like, yeah, you and I can't change the world, but on a personal level, like, what are we doing? What are we doing in our personal lives? What are we involved with? How are we voting?
What are you doing? So, you know, anyone listening out there who's aware it's an emergency and wants to do something straight away, what can we do? What are you doing at a personal sort of home-based level right now?
Oh, good question. We're pretty lucky in the ACT. All of our energy is renewable. So we're leading the way there. I mean, in Australia, 40% of our emissions are coming from electricity generation. So that's a huge one, is actually talking to your provider, forcing government to, you know, shift to renewables. A bit of gardening, ride, all those sorts of little things that I think, I enjoy them more than I see them as a burden.
What other little practices? You ride a bike, you grow some of your own vegetables. I know you've got chickens.
Yeah, the chooks are great. All these things I think are important on a personal level, and they give you some sort of connection to the bigger issues. But, you know, we shouldn't kid ourselves. Like, these problems have to be scaled by politics. And so if we're interested in seeing the great future that we know we can have, it's about pressuring politicians to be upping their game.
And what do you do on that front then? Like, what do you do to agitate at a political level?
Well, emailing your local member, you know, attending, whether it's your local Extinction Rebellion group or whatever the local protest. I think nonviolent direct action is going to become like more and more crucial to actually forcing change in the timescales we need. And I guess the big thing that really interests me and I'm sort of putting my time into at the moment is trying to grapple with how do you actually build a new model of doing things. And that's very much what the Rangelands Restoration Trust is trying to do in Zimbabwe, is how do you take a really pragmatic approach to deal with these big issues and build something that hasn't, you know, there's a lot of people working in this space, but everyone's, you know, trying to figure it out and find a way that works for the people who live there. So I find it exciting. Like I find it incredibly meaningful and energizing. Having said that, I also have my moments. I think one of the things about engaging in this work and kind of allowing yourself to care, and I think it's maybe why we sort of distract and numb ourselves, is that when we actually engage, we realize just how much we've lost and the damage that we're doing. And you know, I think psychologically as a species, to know that you're destroying your home, is that's a huge thing to carry. And this may be controversial, but I You know, I think so much of the mental health issues we're seeing in the Western world stem from this disconnect from nature and actually structuring our lives as if we are human animals, which we are. And, you know, trying to believe that we can live apart from nature and not be part of its rhythms and you know, have to find a way to meet our needs within the boundaries of the earth and its systems. So
how do you, David, deal with the sadness that you see? Because once you lift the lid on all of this, you can't unsee it. And it can be incredibly, incredibly sad.
Mm. I was talking to a reef scientist who works she spent her life on the Great Barrier Reef, working there and talking about the grief and how you actually deal with it. Aldo Leopold, you know, back in the early 1900s, wrote that to have the price of an ecological education is to live in a lonely world of wounds. And I think that kind of speaks to what these reef scientists and people who are really on the front line of monitoring the changes that are taking place are dealing with, is that it does take a toll. And I think having daily practices of gratitude and journaling and meditation are something that I would hate to try and do without. And also, yeah, allowing yourself every now and then just to feel sad and to really grieve, because there's a lot of hopeful stories out there, but generally things aren't good. So I think when we allow ourselves to feel and not try and bottle it up too much and are actually involved in some way in trying to change things, I think it can actually be energizing.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense, because I feel much the same way, and our friendship has been a little bit based around recognizing that, and I know that you recognize that in me, definitely.
Mm. And I mean, I think one of the things we are facing as a society is to actually like really look in the mirror and say, okay, like this way of life has brought us so many benefits, but in so many ways, like, we've really stuffed up. It's not working. We know it can't continue. Something has to change. And that's a hard thing to do, because it's essentially saying, you know, that what we were doing in many ways was wrong. What our parents did was wrong. And I think that in itself takes courage to say, okay, hang on, like this isn't working. I don't know how we get out of here, but we've got a lot of smart people who have spent their lives working on this. So, okay, let's have a crack. And the tragedy in Australia is that we have, we continue to vote for people who are just doubling down on the same old shit, expecting a different result, but just not seeming to care. So, there's certainly a lot we could be doing.
David, I almost feel that that's quite a good note to finish on. And I'll just pick up on something you alluded to there, that there's sadness and there's loneliness. And I know that you've been quoted as saying you're actually getting quite comfortable being weird and different, which is part of that adult journey, you know. But can I ask, you mentioned the word freedom and the idea that we got things wrong. But what that does is open up the possibility of doing things quite differently. In fact, we will have to do things quite differently. Has this space that you've moved into, this climate space that you've dedicated yourself to, has that given you a sense of freedom?
Yeah, I think one of our big failures is a failure of imagination. And, you know, I think it's Rebecca Solnit who points out that as humans, we're far better at imagining the end of the world than like the slow sideways path in a world without end. And that's where we are. Like, you know, it's so easy to just think, oh, doom and gloom, there's nothing I can do. But things can be different and they have to be different. And yeah, I mean, what's more exciting than being part of helping shape the future and, you know, hopefully helping create a future that, you know, we may not get to enjoy, but future generations and, you know, so many of the other species on the planet will, I don't know, hopefully benefit from.
Word. It's hard for me to sum up what I got from hearing how and why Dave made his wild decision, except I am so glad he did, and I'm so glad I have people like him in my life to talk this kind of stuff with. So I actually asked Lindsay, the producer, who nodded her head all the way through our interview, to collate what she got from the interview. This is what she told me. He left me with a lot to keep thinking about, like when his friend Kanye East in Zimbabwe told him, we can't do this because we don't have the money and what we actually need is for you to do it for us. And Lindsay, I think I've got this right. This left you feeling actually fired up as a Westerner to do something because we are the ones that have the power to do it and we're the only ones that can do this change. She enjoyed learning about reading widely and letting yourself go down rabbit holes, swap your car for a bike, that's a good one, but also put pressure on your local politicians to take real action on climate change. I might actually put some notes in the show notes so that anyone who's wanting to get involved at that level, it might help you out. Let yourself be sad and grieve, but don't keep your sadness bottled up. Lindsay added to this that she found the idea of Dave doing a gratitude practice and journaling each day really inspiring, and that she herself still had so much to be grateful for while the planet is still intact and we can enjoy sunrises and the ocean and so on, and that it's important to go through that so that we can keep doing the work to fight for it.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.